What's up, freaks? This is your boy Marty here to introduce this rip of TFTC. This rip was brought to you by our good friends at River. River is a company that's doing it the right way. They build their own infrastructure. They build their own wallets. They're getting their own MTLs. And they've got customer support. You can call River if you have a question. Okay? And they've got a new onboarding plan. So if you go to river.com/TFTC, you sign up, buy $100 worth of Bitcoin, you're going to get $5 worth of Bitcoin. river.com/TFTC. If you want to DCA into Bitcoin, there's no fees when you DCA on River. Other exchanges have high fees, high spreads. You don't have that with River. Save some money by dollar cost averaging with River. Again, they have a customer support line. If you ever have a question, you want to call them, they will answer the phone. My neighbor called them the other week. They answered. They answered his question. They made him feel more comfortable. Good customer service. It's hard to find these days. Not with River. Go to river.com/TFTC. Set up your account today. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends down the hall, Unchained. They're doing things the right way as well, leveraging Bitcoin's native multi-sig properties to bring you the financial platform of the future, a financial platform under a Bitcoin standard. And they have their vaults, which is a 2 or 3 multi-sig wallet where you hold 2 keys, Unchained holds 1. You always have control of your Bitcoin since you have the 2 keys. Unchained's there to collaboratively sign with you if you need them to be the second in the 2 or 3 multi-sig. They also have their lending desk, which is built on this 2 or 3 multi-sig primitive. And you put Bitcoin up as collateral in a 2 or 3 multi-sig escrow. You hold 1 key. You don't control the Bitcoin, but you have visibility into the wallet so that you know your Bitcoin is not being rehypothecated. They also have their IRA product, which allows you to hold 2 keys in a 2 or 3 multi-sig quorum, Unchained being the other key. And you can actually transition your IRA into Bitcoin, hold your own keys. It's a beautiful thing. They've streamlined that process, made it a lot easier within the last month. They've got a lot of things on the roadmap. They're about to go gangbusters on the product rollouts, from what I understand. So stay tuned for that. You can also buy Bitcoin on Unchained. Via their trading desk, you buy Bitcoin, go straight to your 2 or 3 multi-sig vault. So they're doing it the right way. They're really innovating. I think they're one of the best companies in the space. If you are interested in any of these products, go to unchained.com/consultation. Set up a consultation. Tell them that TFTC sent you. Just learn about it. You don't have to ape into their products, but I think you should learn about them. So set up a consultation. They have a concierge onboarding team that'll walk you through everything they're working on. Unchained.com/consultation. This rip was also brought to you by our good friends at Bitcoin Talent Co. It is a recruiting firm built by Bitcoiners for Bitcoiners. So if you're a company in the space looking to hire the best talent, go to Bitcoin Talent Co. and get set up with them. They understand Bitcoin at the protocol level. They understand Lightning. They understand mining. They have the ability to find what you need. And they come from a very strong background in recruiting. Andy led the recruiting team at Uber, taking them from, I believe, 100 to 10,000 employees. He knows what he's doing. He knows how to do this. He knows how to understand your processes. They also just launched their Flex program. So if you don't need full-time employees, if you're being hypercognizant of your burn rate and how you're allocating capital in these tough economic times, their Flex product allows you to tap into a network of workers who can work on contract and can do quick sprints for you, whether it's design, development, marketing, anything that you may need. So go to bitcointalent.co, tell them that TFTC sent you. If you're a company looking to hire full-time employees, if you're looking for some contract work, get set up with them. And then alternatively, if you're talent out there looking to get into the Bitcoin industry, hit them up, get your profile out there, and get your name in the mix to come join the industry building out the Bitcoin standard. Enjoy this rip.
You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
All right, take two. We had to do two takes. Drew, did you get caught in that New York flood the other week?
Fortunately, I did not. Though the New York city infrastructure seems to be crumbling around our feet, it's yet to negatively impact me in any way. But I was looking forward to a swim, so I was hoping that I would have got some of the flash flooding my way.
It's pretty disgusting. What's going on?
It's pretty disgusting.
Is it climate change, or was it the fact that the drains have not been properly maintained for years?
You know, it's a miracle New York City still functions at all. So I would guess the latter. Also, I mean, many folk on Twitter love to dunk on New York City as being the most fucked up place in the world, and in many ways it is. But New York, I do wonder if it is just so Lindy, and if the staying power of New York is so strong that it may even survive the fall of the West in one way or another.
Is the West is falling?
This is, I think, one of the great questions of our time.
Can we save it?
But if the West does fall, something tells me New York will reemerge again.
There's a long line of American cities that are in much worse shape than New York City. New York City at least has, you know, many redeeming qualities. I think that's more than you can say for a great many blue cities in the United States.
I was actually at an event 2 weeks ago. Chatham House rules, so I'm not allowed to talk too much about specifics, but one of the topics was around the scene in New York, and apparently there is a bubbling conservative scene. It's really trying to bring back good aesthetics and good conversations in the middle of New York City, which I don't want to denigrate. Logan's been making fun of my denigrate pronunciation for some times. In Philadelphia, we say denigrate, but don't want to denigrate New York too much. Now I'm thinking too much. But yeah, apparently there's a bubbling scene. There's a lot of Bitcoiners in the middle of it. Apparently, around Alphabet City, there's
I think it's funny because a couple of years ago I moved out of New York because I was just really tired of the culture. It was a very frustrating kind of monoculture where people are just kind of regurgitating like New Yorker, New York Times talking lines. I think there is actually. I think maybe it's always been there, but it's certainly gained some momentum recently. There are some more subversive scenes in New York, and I think there is now a really interesting discourse happening there. I think, Dime Square is like a weird manifestation of one of these physical areas that is basically within a city that's associated with the whole kind of intellectual movement right now, which I think is really fascinating. I do wonder if the last 2 years, New York has now maybe become one of the more interesting intellectual places to live. You know, obviously it's not the Bitcoin capital of the world like Austin or, you know, Nashville is branding itself now as Sovereign Valley. I'm hearing rumors that SF is so back. But I think New York always just has this mix of culture, finance, and especially now with like some of the more new wave dissident online right, like Red Scare adjacent sort of pockets of discourse. I think New York is now a very interesting place to live once more.
At the very least, that's all we could hope for, is just better discourse.
Better discourse.
Ideas competing.
From my very remote perch in, you know, at this undisclosed location in the Mountain West, it certainly seems like the cool kids in New York and other cities are sort of gravitating towards this online, very online right-wing vitalism, if you could call it that. So,
which is interesting because New York is sort of, in many ways, it's very difficult to live a truly vital lifestyle in New York when you're basically slammed into these concrete boxes, incredible density, not that much sunlight. You're pretty far from like the land, certainly far from swimmable beaches and swimmable oceans. But I think just New York, because it's such like a natural shelling point, you're going to attract the diversity of folks regardless. And it's nice that, you know, some pockets that aren't just like Web3 bullshit are getting some more traction in New York right now. But of course, I think also one of the other interesting things is some of the discourse now, and this is pretty, I'd say pretty new, saying that basically SF is actually coming back as well. So it'll be interesting to see how these next few years plays out, because like the staying power of a place with really strong network effects is just a hard thing to overcome and a hard thing to really, really die. I mean, what's it like in Austin right now? Is it still, let's call it the post-COVID wave of like SF tech bros? Is that sort of subsiding or is it still in full force?
Traffic would say that it's still in full force. I'm just going to use the traffic heuristic. If you try to get in the office by 9 a.m., it's a pretty hectic commute. But no, then the scene down here, obviously we had the comedy scene blowing up right down the street here from the Commons with Rogan's Mothership. And so you have a bit of the arts and culture. Historically, music's been the center here and still a prominent theme in the city, but you have these other types of artists, comedians particularly, coming in, and then that keeps the tech bros entertained. You know, they have things to do with their girlfriends and their wives on the weekend. So yeah, I think it's still bubbling. The Bitcoin energy is certainly very strong in this city.
No, for sure.
That's great.
Yeah. Are we doomers? How are we feeling right now on the spectrum of optimism to doomerism?
I guess it depends on what exactly you mean by doomerism. Like,
Mandibles. Is Mandibles going to happen?
Are we the fall of Rome? Probably yes. Are we all going to make it? Probably yes. Certainly Bitcoin gives me a tremendous amount of hope, at least for people like us who appreciate its value and are working towards bringing it to more people.
Yeah. You know, I find myself, as many Bitcoiners do, you know, when you're talking to your normie friends and to your family, you naturally kind of point out some of the things that you think are deeply wrong in the world. And it's easy to just kind of fall back on the system is broken, which I think it is. And, you know, many, many folks don't really want to think that way. But if I were to just describe to you a, let's just at least talk about like, you know, maybe government as a microcosm. If I were to describe a government where laws that are many thousands of pages are passed after being introduced less than a day before, and the people who voted on these laws have not read them, and it's unclear who's written them, this would sound like, to me at least, a broken system. So I think in many respects like that, you know, I do think there are some major headwinds. And as AJ mentioned, you know, if you told me that we're witnessing the decline of the United States empire, I probably would agree with that. But yeah, there are many causes of hope. I would say I'm typically quite optimistic, almost permeable by heart. You know, I like this term I've seen on parts of Twitter, foundationalism or foundationalist, you know, where there's a great opportunity here to kind of reinstate some really important institutions and some important spaces with really important values that can't be forgotten. And so I think there's much exciting stuff happening, even though, you know, so much of this current system remains broken. And, you know, it really is not just the money. Sure, much of it may be downstream of money. Obviously, money is tremendously important. But there's also like a deep cultural issue as well that, you know, whether or not that's downstream of money, I don't know. I think it's a harder case to make that all that's wrong with the culture or all that's wrong with the government is downstream of the money. But I mean, I think we both certainly still believe that sound money and, you know, abundant energy, as the cathedral motto goes, are both keys to human flourishing. Without that, you can't have human flourishing, but there might be much wrong beyond that.
Agreed. I think fixing the money, bringing the foundationalist perspective to that, let's fix the foundation of society, our economy more broadly, by fixing the money. And then yes, the things that are downstream or may not be downstream, once you fix the money, you can begin focusing on them more intently, with more intent. And it's funny, I open up with this type of conversation because I agree with what you said, AJ. Bitcoin does provide me a lot of optimism. I do think it's a very potent tool in this cultural generational battle that we're having as we transition further into the digital age. And that's why I'm happy to talk to you guys right now as we sit around $28,000. You guys are running Cathedra, a Bitcoin mining company. We're almost 15 years into Bitcoin's existence. The white paper anniversary is 3.5 weeks away.
Got a decade. Holy crap. 15 years? 15. That happened quick. I feel like last year was 10.
Yeah. 15, a decade and a half. Wow. A decade and a half and 3.5 weeks since the white paper was launched. And I think we all agree that Bitcoin is this very important tool, but only 15 years in, even though it seems like a long time, in the grand scheme of things, it's a very short amount of time. We're learning a lot of lessons. There's a lot of trial and error that has happened over these 15 years within the Bitcoin space, whether it be how do you update the protocol? How do you scale the protocol? How do you build a mining operation efficiently? How do you pitch Bitcoin to people? And so we're going to focus on the mining aspect of it in this conversation. I think a lot of lessons have been learned in the mining industry over the last 2 years. The last time we talked was, had to be 2022 early. We were still outside at my house.
Drinking some Coors Lights.
So what have we learned since then? About a year and a half ago, since we last talked, near coming off the all-time highs at the end of 2021, what lessons has the mining industry learned since the top of the last bull market?
Yeah, you know, it's a great question. And I think, you know, as we think about what it was like to sit on your couch and to talk through the way we looked at the world at the time, though, I mean, the world was just such a different place. We were in the middle of a global energy crisis. We were just about to start the most aggressive period of interest rate hikes in many decades. And, you know, I think as we've, many of the themes that have been going on since before then have certainly seemed to continue. But I think, you know, being on now like the other side of, say, like a regional banking crisis and, you know, these crazy, basically government sanctions that freeze another government's financial assets to the tune of hundreds of billions of dollars, I think we've basically just seen the importance and the use case of Bitcoin only increase. But it feels like another lifetime ago when we were sitting in Marty's couch.
It really does. That would have been pre Russia Ukraine war as well.
Mm-hmm. Probably right before it had to be right before it happened.
Yeah. I mean the world very much, to your point, Drew, looks and feels like a very different place. What has the mining industry learned specifically? I would say one of the most obvious takeaways is highly volatile balance sheet assets and debt do not mix well. There have obviously been a number of very high profile bankruptcies in the Bitcoin mining space, but also in the broader crypto ecosystem, if you want to call it that. I think people are much more focused today on making their operations more efficient and preparing for the halving, which I'm sure we'll talk about. It's coming up in probably less than 6 months at this point. Then they were concerned with things like growth and getting their hash rate numbers as big as possible when we last met. And I think that holds true for us to some extent as well. Like the way we were approaching the business in Q1 2022, when it was still not clear that we were entering a different market regime characterized by aggressive interest rate hikes and a sell-off in basically all risk assets, we were thinking about things very differently than we started to call it summer of 2022, when we went a little bit risk off and started to focus more on plugging in machines, even if they weren't at, even if it wasn't in the most ideal situation, just to get revenue online, shoring up our balance sheet and focusing more on efficiency and making sure our operations were dialed in. Did you agree with that?
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, again, rewinding, going back in time, sitting on your couch, Marty, AJ and I had joined Cathedra, or then Fortress, now Cathedra, and it was Cathedra at that time. We joined in end of September 2021. At that time we were still in the middle of these large mining SPACs, many of whom had zero deployed hash rate. You were seeing everyone go public, everyone raising a ton of money. And the reality is that mining is a scale game. And so we were definitely thinking, we're definitely focused on that. And we were at the time very focused on the off-grid opportunity. And we were going, we were manufacturing our boxes, looking to go take advantage of flared and stranded gas wherever possible, just because there's so much white space. And there still is so much white space there for Bitcoin mining. But, you know, as executives and running a company, really your job is to surf the waves as they come in. And the reality is that by the time, say, we were ready to do our first off-grid deployments in early 2022, actually not that far after we talked, the global energy crisis had really changed the landscape for off-grid Bitcoin mining. You went from being in an environment where you could buy gas for maybe half a penny per kilowatt hour and lease generators for 3.5 cents per kilowatt hour to an environment where, you know, oil's ripping, natural gas is ripping, you know, to such an extreme that some countries like Pakistan had to exit the LNG market altogether because gas was just so expensive because of the European energy crisis. It became a global energy crisis. And so that call it three cent for leasing a generator and half a cent for buying, say, flare gas ballooned out to 1 to 2 cents for maybe buying the gas and then 7-8 cents for leasing a generator. So at that point, you're paying more than retail hosting rates. And you're still responsible for all the CapEx and all the operational issues. So to AJ's point, at that point, the only logical move was to then just go get these machines deployed elsewhere using third-party infrastructure that was, you know, we were able to get some good deals on. And, you know, we, of course, still had an eye towards working, you know, to get off-grid, which we are now. But the reality is that as a CEO and, you know, president of a Bitcoin mining company, you're a portfolio manager of hash rate, or you're managing a portfolio of hash rate, rather. And so really your job is to just produce the best returns possible given the current environment that you're in. And I mean, I guess I can keep going through some of the other things that sort of changed since then, because I think the genesis of sort of how we got to where we currently are certainly I think there's been many interesting lessons learned over the last over those last 2 years.
Agreed. And before we jump into the individual strategy that you guys have employed at Cathedra, I do think it's important to talk and touch on some broader themes too, because I mean, what you just described, this global energy crisis that sort of popped up in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war, and the interest rate regime that came alongside that. Like, I think it's also important to back up 6 to 8 months as well, because here in America, particularly, we have the China ban in the summer of 2021, and then that Great Migration. And so the price was ripping. Everybody here in the United States saw this massive opportunity to take a large share of the hash rate and plug it in on U.S. soil. And so the bullish tenor of the market at that particular point in time was palpable. The energy was, pun intended, very high. And it's just the whole industry sort of ran into this buzzsaw of macroeconomic headwinds at the same time when it was viewed as this incredible opportunity, which it certainly was, and there people took great advantage of that opportunity, but there was just these conflicting sort of themes going on where there's this opportunity to take hash rate from China, and then you run into the global macro buzzsaw at the same time.
Yeah, totally. And to your exact point around that China ban, so you have the China ban happen in summer of 2021. Bull market still very much going. Obviously, we did dip down to 30K, but it was still very much bull market vibes. And so around that summer and into that fall, when you have everyone in the U.S. chasing that opportunity, many of them built very, very large data centers. It takes a long time to build a large data center. Many of those data centers were only coming online in Q2, Q3 of 2022. And as a result, you basically have these massive data centers being built by companies, often with leverage, that took a long time. They started being built in the bull market. They aren't really finished until the bull market's coming to an end. We're entering a bear market. And because of the energy crisis, at that time, it was so expensive to put on a hedge for your power prices that many of these large companies, many of whom are now bankrupt, basically had data centers coming online in Q2, Q3, 2022, as the bull market's coming to an end, as energy prices are still quite high. So they don't have the capital markets are closed. They can't. They don't really have the money to put on a hedge. And as a result, they basically ended up upside down selling fixed and buying floating. And I think that's why we saw many of these bankruptcies like Compute North and Core Scientific. Of course, the fact that they were had a lot of leverage just didn't help either. But I think, yeah, it was basically the perfect storm for that kind of buzzsaw. And of course, I mean, then there's the whole BlockFi and Luna, 3AC, Celsius collapse as well. I mean, definitely it was sort of the perfect confluence of events to just cause max pain for many people.
Yeah, it's a miracle any of us are alive after all that. when you sort of articulate everything in order, like China, ban, all right, we're going to get all this hash rate, price ripping, new ASICs being deployed by the manufacturers, high efficiency, yeah, high hash rate. Everybody's like, let's go. And then boom, you run into this buzzsaw. And I think that's why I'm particularly excited about this conversation today, is because I think you guys are an incredible example of a management team. Disclosure, I'm a director at Cathedra, so obviously some bias here, but I do think the way in which you guys reacted to these headwinds as they were unfolding in 2022 is a great example of being proactive and sort of not hitching your wagon to ideas during a different market environment in late 2021. So I guess let's fast forward to late spring, early summer 2022. What were some of the moves you guys made seeing all this stuff unfolding that have allowed you to survive to today, late 2023?
Yeah. So it was around the time of the Luna collapse that it became pretty clear to us that, you know, our thesis about a hash price super cycle or like a bull market that was going to continue through 2022 was plainly wrong. And so call it May, June of 2022, we took a number of steps to make sure that basically we were on sides from an operation standpoint, but also from a balance sheet perspective. So one of the first things we did was we went out and sold all of the Bitcoin that we had on balance sheet at a price of around 30K, which for, you know, two Bitcoin maximalists like us was extremely painful. I think Drew probably still has PTSD from that weekend conversation that we had.
Yeah, no, basically I'm up in New Hampshire. At the time, I'm basically like subletting some random room over this, you know, in some like woman's house, because I'd moved up there to oversee the manufacturing operation. And I remember sitting outside, looking at the Androscoggin River up there and just, you know, talking to AJ. At the time, I felt a lot of resistance because I never really sold Bitcoin in my life. And then just, you know, sitting there smoking a cigarette and just like, fuck, okay, I guess we do have to do this. And I mean, looking back, I think that decision was a really important one for making sure we withstood the storm, because yeah, I mean, it only got worse from there.
Yeah. And we used the proceeds from that to basically pay off a bunch of debt that we had taken out, you know, in hindsight at the very top of the market. And then in conjunction with that, we went out and did a small equity round. We raised about $6 million to further fortify the balance sheet. We sold some of the latest generation machines that we had coming in the next few months. I think it ended up being like 400 of the S19 XPs that we had coming in. We sold for cash. That ended up being a really good trade. I think we sold them in the, you know, above $40 a terahash, yeah, which at the time, again, was very painful because we, you know, it felt like the machine prices had already declined a lot. And in hindsight, it ended up being a very good trade. So that gave us kind of gave us what we needed from a balance sheet perspective to last through the worst of it. And then from an operation standpoint, we basically just started plugging in machines on grid at third-party hosted locations and facilities that we had leased, instead of pursuing the initial plan that we had to basically go down this path of building a vertically integrated off-grid miner where we own everything from, you know, these modular containers that we build ourselves in-house to the ASICs inside them, and then potentially even down to the energy asset.
Yeah. And just to touch, I think you bring up, like, there's a couple interesting, Marty, to your first question about some of the lessons that, you know, I think we've all learned in the through this bear market. And I think everyone learned these lessons in particular. One, to the point around selling the machines, we all learned just that the ASIC market is really not that liquid. And, you know, back when AJ and I were at Galaxy, I spent a lot of time working on the ASIC-backed lending product that we had, where we basically provide ASICs to miners and we'd finance them over time. And the idea was always, you know, worst case scenario, the miner doesn't pay and then we foreclose on the ASICs and then we just sell the ASICs. But I think as we learned, the market really was not that liquid in the end. And so as these miners who had these ASIC-backed loans were watching their margins get crushed, the value of the collateral and the loans was also getting crushed. And so many an ASIC was seized. But, you know, as a microcosm of this, the XPs, at the time when we sold them, I think we sold them for like $49 a terahash or something like that. And the current prevailing market indexes, and if you went on Telegram chats and were looking at quotes, the quotes were all in, you know, $60 per terahash, something like that. And so you're seeing this one price on the ticker. But when you actually need to go close a transaction, you were seeing a very, very different price. And so I think there's a really general lesson there for just selling assets during times of stress anyway, and even just the fact that markets are often not as liquid as you think that they are.
The ask in a Telegram channel is a much different price than where the deal gets done, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And then also, I think in terms of selling the Bitcoin, you know, as Bitcoin maxis, we all believe that this is going to, you know, $1 million and you know, at some point in the near future, right? Whether that's like 5 years or 20, I'm not really sure. But we're all really, really bullish long term. But the reality is that, you know, now coming out of this experience, I think our risk management attitudes have totally changed, where we are that bullish. But you know, you can't let yourself get in a position where you need to, where you're jeopardizing the business surviving. You know, but basically, if the business dies before we see $1 million Bitcoin, then we've lost anyway. So the number one name of the game, basically, as executives, as fiduciaries, is just to make sure that the company stays alive and to look out for shareholders, even if it sort of pains us to sell what at the time wasn't really, what certainly wasn't the bottom. But it was certainly still painful to sell after seeing, you know, a 50% drawdown.
Yeah, I mean, there was almost another 50% drawdown. It was definitely 35 to 40% after that. So,
yeah.
And we're still below that point right now.
One of the other lessons, I think, is just it was a stark lesson about the nature of the Bitcoin mining business and like what business it is that we're in. It's not really like, you know, most of the time hash price and therefore your profitability is declining. And it's only these very, very brief periods that last for 9 to 18 months where hash price is actually going up and you earn, you know, 90% of the returns that make this a worthwhile business. And if you're not staying in the game to benefit from those very brief periods, then you're in the wrong business. So yes, as Drew said, surviving at any cost is really the name of the game. And at this point, it looks like we're hopefully in the early stages of the next bull market, and we're just excited to be around to benefit from it.
Yeah, totally. And then I think part of the it definitely was easier to, I think looking back on all those decisions, I think we absolutely made the right choices, and I feel very good about those decisions we made. Certainly also it was interesting to, or it felt good to see many of the other miners end up having to sell substantially all their Bitcoin as well at much lower prices. But you know, I think AJ, like to your point, you basically just need to stay in the game. You need to stay alive. And to that end, when it came to deploying our machines at third-party data centers, you know, is it as sexy as like flare gas mining? No, but it, from a, like a capital and machine allocation standpoint, it was absolutely the decision that maximized returns for those ASICs. And that really is like your job at the end of the day. It's just, how can I get as many sats in the door as possible? How can we maximize returns?
Yeah. And another part of that too, which I think you guys have really spearheaded, been vocal about, and is being recognized by the market, is being efficient with that fleet as well. So trying to gauge what your cost of electricity is, where the difficulty is, where the hash rate is, where the hash price is, and really optimizing the fleet to ensure that you're getting the best profit margin possible. Maybe not the highest hash rate. And I think this is a really important theme to really dig into, is historically, particularly with US publicly traded miners, the name of the game is just get that get that hash rate number up as high as possible, and you'll be rewarded by the public markets for doing that. But I think what you guys have proven, what you would argue, is that is not the most efficient way to run a mining business or the most profitable way at the end of the day. And so let's get into underclocking and maintaining the efficiency of your fleet of hash rate.
Yeah. So I guess maybe picking up the story where AJ kind of where we left off. So, you know, over the summer, we're just trying to get machines plugged in. Fortunately, because there was some idle infrastructure with some other folks falling down, we're able to get some pretty good hosting deals there. Then, of course, in the fall, you know, things kept getting worse from a hash price perspective, from a Bitcoin price perspective. Obviously, we saw FTX collapse in epic fashion. And, you know, I think there's I'm personally tired of seeing the SBF FTX articles on Twitter. So I think we don't need to get too much into that. But
it doesn't have enough Adderall.
Just doesn't.
Michael Lewis would like a word with you, Drew.
Yeah. If only we had more effective altruists who were, you know, ripped out on amphetamines and, you know, engaging in some very interesting lifestyle practices. Maybe there would be hope again. But anyway, the it come like the November, December sort of like real depths of the bear market. We once again had had these, you know, we had some machines that needed to be plugged in. As we looked around, really the returns for plugging these machines in anywhere were really not very good. And I think this is really where Isaac and Reet deserve a ton of credit. Isaac, our CFOMO, and Reet, our CTO, who I think they did an excellent job walking through some of the details of this on their podcast they did with you back in February or March, Marty. But they basically were, Isaac had this wacky idea, well, what if we just jam a bunch of machines into our legacy Washington site and put 50% of the power draw into them? To me, that just sounded insane. Like, well, I've never heard of anyone doing this. This is just a ridiculous idea. But as we walked through it, and as he tested it and showed that we could get 23 joules per terahash with an S19J Pro using aftermarket firmware and underclocking, it all of a sudden became a no-brainer because our cost at that site remained unchanged, and we basically just doubled our hash rate at that site. And so it was pretty, I think that the constraints of the bear market really led to some amazing ingenuity. And now that underclocking is really a core part of our strategy, where, you know, each month we'll look at the different sites that we have and we'll basically say, is this the most efficient clock given the cost of power and given the hash price? Or should we change this? Should we underclock? Should we move the clock back up closer to stock settings? And that has really unlocked a whole new sort of area for us to optimize operations. Just each month, what can we do to maximize cash flow coming through the door? And then, you know, I think Isaac and Reed have really pushed that idea to the extreme in a way that I haven't really seen many other folks doing in this industry.
Yeah, just to give you a sense of the magnitude of the effect that this has on our sort of our hash rate numbers. So I think if we were running all of our machines at stock today, we'd probably be between 450 and 500 petahash per second in like headline hash rate. And I think the number that we disclosed this week to the market that we're actually realizing is about 355 petahash per second. And the difference there is, again, like that's the difference between us running them at stock and using this firmware to reduce the power draw and reduce the hash rate, but also, you know, maximize the amount of actual net cash flow that we're taking in each month. I think the way most of the large publicly traded miners are doing it is, as you said, Marty, optimizing for the hash rate number, being able to announce like, oh, we reached, you know, 5.5, 6, 7 exahash, without regard for like whether they're maximizing the amount of cash flow that they could be taking in each month through underclocking.
Yeah. And do you think, I'm trying to think of like how to tactfully approach this question, but let's just jump into it. Like moving forward, like, do you think there's going to be, obviously there's bias involved in this, but I'm pretty convinced that the public markets investors are going to get smarter and begin to appropriately price these businesses and just not fall for the, hey, we got 6.5, 7 exahash, and really dig into the numbers. Like, all right, what is your actual profit margin with this fleet of hash rate? Like, do you think we're going to see a sea change in how these companies are viewed and put plainly, our equity analysts are going to get smarter and actually understand mining businesses better.
I definitely think so. I think what it will take to see the like tier one and tier two public miners adopt some of these practices is basically one of them just doing it. Like as soon as Riot or Marathon announces that they're using aftermarket firmware to underclock, it's going to be sort of a race from all the others to follow suit. And I think, you know, the metrics that that investors and equity analysts use to evaluate these companies will continue to be standardized and refined. I think, you know, probably this time last year, if you had mentioned the word or the phrase hash price to an equity analyst, they probably would have had no idea what you're talking about. And that has sort of become an industry standard in many senses. And I think, not to pat ourselves on the back too much, but in our most recent MD&As that we put out each quarter, we've tried to do a good job of like disclosing some of these metrics and how we are performing on that basis. So for example, each quarter we put out a break-even hash price number that says, all right, if hash price falls to such a level, when will we stop generating positive cash flow at each individual site and things like that. So I think, the industry has a long way to go, but it's going to continue improving. And as soon as some of the larger guys start to do it, it'll become really, really incumbent upon the others to adopt the same practices.
I think that's probably true, but I'll take sort of the bearish view that I don't think they're going to be adopting it anytime soon, because I think for a lot of these like large guys, look, they're sticking with the recipe that they've seen work. They're able to unlock potentially some very, very large compensation packages for themselves in doing so. And like, you know, they've grown, they've raised equity to buy hash rate, and they've communicated growth targets to the market, and they want to hit those growth targets. And I think many of them are probably just going to keep on doing that until they're basically forced not to. And I mean, underclocking does also really complicate the way you communicate information about your business, because metrics like uptime don't really make sense anymore. Hash rate becomes this variable thing, as opposed to something that an equity research analyst can just plug into a model. So, you know, I think it makes it maybe a little harder to for people, unless they really understand mining, to really understand the business and what we're doing. But I mean, really what we're doing this for is trying to produce the most value for the company as possible, for shareholders as possible. You know, AJ and I are both substantial shareholders ourselves, and so we want the company to succeed. And you know, we care about actually producing returns, and to the extent we can, versus basically just chasing growth for the sake of growth. So we'll see. But I think to this end, it's we've only seen the beginning of firmware and underclocking, I think, in particular in this industry.
Yeah, that's probably right. I'd say there's probably another full like bull market, bear market cycle to go before equity investors really start to punish some of the companies that have been, number one, not very prudent with dilution, and also with sort of these games they play with the metrics they're disclosing, just to sort of like, again, raise capital and line the pockets of the executives.
Yeah, and there's another aspect here too, which is the ability with particular firmware to underclock and eke out these profit margins or increased profit margins exists. But you also have the educational piece on the side of the power companies when you're setting up these deals. Say, hey, this is our strategy for mining to optimize our profitability at any given point in time. We need some flexibility within our contract to be able to oscillate our energy pool, at different points in the market. And so how do you guys see that evolving, these conversations between the power providers and the miners that want to employ these type of strategies?
No, it's a really great piece, because I mean, really, it's a great point. I should say everyone cares about flexibility, right? If you're a power company, you might want a 90 PPA with 90% uptime. So that way, in the extreme circumstances where, maybe the cost of power elsewhere on the grid is really skyrocketing, you want the ability to take advantage of that and to sell that. We as miners obviously want the flexibility to not be committed to a certain amount of power. And whether you have a fixed PPA or maybe like a rate schedule from a vertically integrated utility, this is all very, very different. So it's definitely something we care about a lot, where in all of our like key hosting contracts, And certainly in the sites that we control, we reserve the ability to adjust the clocks. So that way we can maximize the basically operating margin that we're getting from it. And I think moving forward, really what, you know, to your point, how is mining going to look differently? I think you're going to see a lot more diversity and biodiversity within Bitcoin mining. So it's not just going to be big box data centers where folks are plugging in, you know, new machines, running them till they're not profitable, then swapping them out for new machines. I think you'll start to see low uptime, low cost of power mm-hmm. sites. You know, maybe a site where it's only up 30% of the time, but the cost of power is so cheap, you can afford to run S9s or M20Ss and still make a really an interesting return there. You know, we think about what it will look like when transaction fees make an even larger portion of miner revenue. You're even going to see folks switching online only to take advantage of these brief moments of really high transaction fees that elevate hash price. And so I think the whole mining industry is going to become much more dynamic. And I think much in the same way where miners are going to seek really interesting power strategies that potentially have low uptime and low cost of power, you're also going to see this saturation of aftermarket firmware so that miners can always be optimizing clocks depending on what they're seeing on the grid. You know, if you're mining in Texas and the cost of power goes negative, you want to suck as much power as you possibly can from the spot market. And so you maybe want to overclock all of your machines to the extent you can. Now, it will require having overbuilt infrastructure to give you that flexibility to do so. But the whole game is about to become much more dynamic. I think to date, mining has been a very simple game of get newest machine, get low cost power, plug in. And it's now about to get much more complex. It's about to turn into 4D chess if it isn't already.
I think it's also a... it'll also lead to the something we talked about in the past, Marty, but like the increased integration of mining at the actual site of power generation by the companies that are generating the power themselves. So it's not going to be, I think it'll be less pure play miners partnering with power providers and more companies that look like a mix of the two that are perhaps using mining not as their primary revenue source, but as an ancillary source of revenue to support the sale of electricity or something like that. And in that situation, mining becomes much less important. The uptime in any given day becomes less important because the two sort of support each other.
Yeah. No, and I think this underclocking aspect of it and this aftermarket firmware is probably like the first domino to fall, which provides mining companies or energy companies with the tools necessary to go after these types of strategies.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And I think, you know, of course, there's been this question where, like, when are the first energy companies really going to be, like, acquiring Bitcoin mining businesses and stuff like that? And, you know, clearly we're not there yet. Marty, you and I and AJ, maybe you probably would agree. I think we probably would have thought we would have been there by now mm-hmm. if you asked us in 2020. But, you know, I think it is definitely coming. And basically, it just the idea of ASIC as a load bank, it just is going to give energy companies a lot more flexibility. But to your point around underclocking, especially this aftermarket firmware, I think by the time this podcast comes out, we will have released our own firmware, our Cathedra firmware, where and maybe it might just make sense to talk about this a little bit. You know, I think there's many firmware products out there, many aftermarket firmware. And you have BrainsOS Plus, you have many others. And I think they all have called it different puts and takes, but it's all very like scary business at the end of the day, because you're basically jailbreaking your machine. And you know that if you jailbreak your machine and you break it forever, it's broken and you're not getting any...
Bitmain's not going to honor your warranty requests.
Yeah, exactly. So it's definitely like Wild West out there with firmware. And we have done a ton of work on testing different firmware, trying to find the best. And when I say we, I mean, I especially shout out to Isaac and Reet who have really done an amazing job. They really grok ASICs and thinking through, you know, as they told you on the podcast, thinking through ASICs from first principles. What are the effects of voltage and frequency? How does this change in different temperature environments? What are the different nuances or ants that can get you if you, you know, if you start playing this game? Because a change in temperature, if you have assigned an ASIC to a static voltage and frequency, a change in temperature can totally change the efficacy of that clock. And so these are some of the really important considerations to have. And so what we basically are doing now with our firmware is we're basically sharing the best tools that we found, sharing, you know, if you download our firmware, you can join a private Telegram group where we're going to kind of help you and provide you with some of the clocks that have been most useful to us, share some of the most useful strategies and most important lessons that we've learned in doing so. And so our hope is that we can really help get more people into this underclocking game. It's a weird scenario where it's actually kind of win-win, where if, you know, if multiple miners were to underclock, we're not really hurting each other. We're all just improving our own profit margins, and network hash rate even like marginally comes down. Now, of course, we don't think the whole world's going to use our firmware, but many people have asked us, you know, how did you get these results? How did you get the S19J Pro down to 23 joules a terahash? And our intent in making this firmware publicly available and sharing with everyone is basically just to share this knowledge that we've had and to basically help more people use these tools that we found incredibly helpful, because it's not really zero sum. Like, mining's a brutally competitive business, but in this context, it's certainly not a zero sum game where if we help other people breathe more life into their machines, it actually benefits all of us.
I think you forgot to mention, Drew, that we'll also be taking a small development fee off of any hash rate that uses our
firmware. I mean,
it's not purely altruistic.
It's not like purely, we're not doing this as a charity, but like it does benefit folks for sure.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And I think like the intent is to do it very much in the spirit of the way things are done in Bitcoin, where it's, you know, it's not like quite open source, but anyone can download the firmware and join the Telegram group. If you begin using the firmware, that's when we get paid. And I think it's like 1% of the hash rate goes to us. And so from our perspective, it's a really interesting way to potentially expand our hash rate exposure without investing another dollar in machines or infrastructure. So I'm not sure like how material it will be to the bottom line on day one, but I could see it being a pretty appreciable product over the course of, you know, years to come.
Completely agree. And that's, I mean, one thing we've learned in the mining industry, I'll just speak personally, like being in it for 5-6 years now, almost, is trying to reduce the pure ASIC exposure risk and diversify. Like, how do you accumulate hash rate without buying an ASIC? And this is a great way to do that in my mind.
Totally.
No, I think
if you understand that ASICs are really a shitcoin.
Yeah,
I mean, that's one thing that we've seen with this announcement from Bitmain in the last couple of weeks that I think has been shocking to many people. Just the scale of their manufacturing abilities and like how many machines they can really put onto the market in a very short amount of time. I think, it's a little bit shocking to people, and people are going to be much more conscious of entering into these futures orders when you have no idea how much hash rate is coming online and when.
Yeah, I mean, so let's educate any of the listeners who may be ignorant to what Bitmain has announced. They've announced their S21 series, both air-cooled and hydro-cooled. They'll be coming in at, 16.5 joules per terahash? They'll be selling them for $14 a terahash. Is that correct?
Yeah, so there's some nuance there around whether it's the S21 or the S21 hydro. And I think the pricing is also subject to fluctuate as well. But yeah, they definitely came in with a bargain basement price for what is by far the most efficient miner on the market.
And how much hash rate are they going to be producing again?
I think it depends whether it's the S21 or the S21 hydro, but we're talking like, close to 200, call it roughly 200 terahash. And I mean, I think what's really crazy about this too is that if you think about the price that they're coming in at, they're basically undercutting what the current market rate for XPs is. So I think if one wanted to put some tin foil on their head, They might question whether...
Marty's not one to do that. You can just stop right there.
Of course not. Sorry, I forgot. Marty prefers to stick to his CNN takes. But I think they might be trying to bleed dry some of their competitors, because as we know, in addition to mining being a ruthlessly competitive business, so is ASIC manufacturing. And, you know, I think if they can stick with this really low pricing at $14 a terahash, I think it's reasonable to assume that they have a lower cost of production than both MicroBT and Canaan and these other new ASIC manufacturers, just because they're so scaled, they've been doing it for so long, and they probably have the largest amount of capacity with TSMC of any of these manufacturers. And so things could get really interesting if all of these ASIC manufacturers keep putting the pedal to the metal. it will get really interesting in terms of thinking through what mining will look like in the next bull run. Essentially, ASICs. Yeah, ASICs not really being the bottleneck anymore, yeah. Potentially being infrastructure.
Yeah, that's another trend we've been thinking a lot about, is the shift from the bottleneck being ASICs to power and data center infrastructure for mining. I think when we joined, part of the reason that one of the first things we did when we joined Cathedra was to enter into these futures contracts with Bitmain was, you know, we had come of age in Bitcoin mining where ASICs were sort of the scarce commodity, and it was really hard to get the latest generation of ASICs from China. And I think in the last, certainly the last year, that's sort of flip-flopped, where now it's much harder to get cheap power in a cost-effective way than it is to get the latest generation of ASICs. And I think that will probably continue to be the case. Like, there's all sorts of powerful narratives that are aligned to bring on more semiconductor manufacturing capacity, I think. Things like bringing more manufacturing over to the West from the East, the whole AI craze that's going on right now. And I think conversely, when it comes to power, despite Marty's best efforts, the ESG thing still has some steam left in it. And there does seem to be like narratives that are aligned against bringing on really cheap and reliable power. So
yeah, we're going to kill the ESG narrative. It's just going to take a while.
I mean,
it's dying. It feels like it's dying for sure.
It definitely feels like it's dying. I mean, I think the hierarchy of needs reasserts itself quickly. But I think to your point, AJ, about this infrastructure bottleneck, I had a tweet thread about this last year, but or earlier this year, I think. But if we just think about in a post-halving world, if Bitcoin were to 10x in price, for a hash price to remain flat at around like this $60 per petahash level that we're at now, that would mean that the Bitcoin network would need to consume something like 50 gigawatts more of power, which is really an insane amount of power. That's, you know, Texas is basically half of Texas, if not a little bit more, in terms of power capacity. And it just takes a long time to build that type of energy infrastructure. And even with the white space of, say, off-grid flare gas mining or methane mining, you really have some other bottlenecks that start to appear, like the generators. Mm-hmm. How can I turn that methane into electricity? And so really the bull case for Bitcoin mining, especially in the call it this near to midterm, is that it's going to take so much for that much hash rate to, or for so much infrastructure to bring that hash rate online, that once again, I think there'll be a really interesting window for miners to really capitalize on, you know, bullish move in Bitcoin price. And one of the first lessons I think AJ and I learned in Bitcoin mining was back in like 2020 almost. You're either hashing or you're not. And there's nothing more important than just having hash rate on the ground, staying in the game, so that when that bullish price action comes, you're there to take advantage of it, because it will take network hash rate a while to catch up. It always does.
Yeah, and AJ, you touched on it, but I think it's a very important theme to explore too, is AI and the energy demand that it brings to the market. And AI, hottest chick on the block right now, but more importantly, like, some of the most respected backers, you got Microsoft, Google, Facebook, OpenAI. These guys have a lot of capital, and if we're being honest with ourselves, they'll probably get priority in a lot of these energy deals. So that's another thing. You have this competition for energy, which is already scarce. It's going to heat up not only between Bitcoin miners, but between miners and AI companies with their GPUs. And again, if we're being honest with ourselves, like, I wouldn't be surprised if the AI companies get preferential treatment, which in a roundabout way actually makes Bitcoin mining more bullish in that scenario where there's a lot of demand
for people who already have hash rate, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if something tells me, despite the best efforts of some of our friends in DC, the collective lobbying power of the AI industry probably dwarfs the good work that many of our pro Bitcoin lobbyists are doing.
Yeah. I mean, I think also with when it comes to AI, it's funny because this AI high performance compute market, right? Like, it's been around for a long time. I remember AJ and I looking at HPC and pitch decks of Bitcoin miners back at Galaxy in like 2019. And it never really left those pitch decks. Like, it was still there, even though the market never really developed. But obviously the last year, with ChatGPT and with Stable Diffusion and Midjourney, like, it now seems like we finally hit this escape velocity where it's here. It seems like it's going to be here to stay. I do think there's some nuance that maybe gets lost in some of the discourse where everyone's incentivized to change their name to XAI at this point, right? And to start basically start trying to raise money on that. But in many ways, it seems like this AI high performance compute business is going to be pretty similar to Bitcoin mining, where, you know, currently right now, the hardware, the computers, the GPUs, they're the scarce resource, they're the bottleneck. And much like ASICs, they seem to basically be getting priced based on the current margins associated with using them for rendering or for training LLMs. And so you basically have this interesting thing where the CapEx is always going to scale with the margin at that point in time, which makes for really interesting or really easy to just get wrecked if demand falls off. Weirdly, though, people are already comfortable with like GPU-backed debt. And I just had a tweet this morning, you know, I do wonder whether we're going to end up in a similar environment where like the HPC market's going to suffer many of the same pitfalls as Bitcoin mining, including this like GPU backed debt market that basically is susceptible to the same reflexivity on the way down that ASIC backed debt was back in 2022. But it definitely seems like it is here to stay. But you know, I think it's probably true that 98% of the call it AI startups that you read about are not for real. Like, they're not going to make it. And I'm not going to say that they're scams, but I think it's possible that 98% of it's noise and it's still here to stay, much in the same way that, you know, with like crypto, whatever, there is real signal in Bitcoin, but there's most of what you hear about in the industry is just noise.
I completely agree with that. And all things like the cycles of the hardware, the hype cycle that exist, it is going to be fascinating to see. And again, like anchoring back to the power brokers within the AI industry, like, and they're well capitalized from other lines of business that they have, whether it's Microsoft, Facebook, OpenAI is pure AI, but they're pretty well established at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the other thing too with the GPUs. I do think they'll have an ASIC-like cycle, but it may be less pronounced due to the fact that they're not a special purpose as a Bitcoin mining ASIC.
Yeah, I was going to say it'll definitely be volatile. I would be surprised if it's quite as volatile as Bitcoin and ASICs. And just thinking through, maybe because demand for something like Bitcoin, and of course Bitcoin supply Bitcoin supply is perfectly inelastic. Supply for GPUs and compute is not so. And also, I think the demand for Bitcoin probably fluctuates a lot more secularly with you know, changes in monetary policy and macro backdrop. But I think you guys are absolutely right. They're probably going to relearn some of the hard lessons that ASIC-backed lenders and miners have learned in the last couple of years. So yeah, it'll be fun to watch play out.
Yeah. And even though I did mention that there's going to be this competition for the energy, that I think in the short to medium term, AI may get preferential treatment. And I'm interested to battle test this idea with you guys, because I think in the long run, like, they're going to have to be co-located, particularly if you're training models and you want the cheapest power. One of the best ways to get cheap power, particularly on grid, is to be able to participate in demand response. And we know, for training models, downtime is not an option. So if you want to participate in demand response programs, you're going to have ASICs co-located with your GPUs that have that interruptible load aspect that can actually respond to demand response.
Totally.
That allows you to lock in that lower price.
Yeah. Another great example of, you know, Bitcoin mining being used as like a supplemental or ancillary revenue stream in support of a primary revenue stream. I could totally see that happening.
But one point also that I as a disclaimer, I'm not like HPC, GPU, AI, LLM training expert. But I do wonder if there would actually be a market for call it like value HPC, where, you know, Google, you know, Microsoft, these companies often like their data centers have like, you know, 5-9 stipulations where it's very, very high uptime. They care a lot about redundancy. I do wonder if there'll basically be a market for call it more like budget HPC, where maybe the work, maybe there's a way to interrupt that work. Maybe it takes longer to do it. It's over, you know, instead of being done kind of like on an ASAP basis, maybe it's
lower priority.
Mm-hmm. But as a result, it would allow those operators to participate in an HPC type, in a demand response type program, so that they can secure the lowest cost power. And yet it won't get you, you know, it's not the same redundancy or the same resilience or the same uptime, but you basically benefit from that on the cost side of things.
Yeah, and I can certainly see that happening. Like all the big AI companies are competing for very similar models, but you can imagine a scenario in the future where somebody has a very specific model idea that nobody's really thought of, and they have the luxury for that interruption in the training.
Totally. And like, I mean, at the end of the day, that I think that is at least that's how a Bitcoin miner thinks about it, because once again, you know, we're cockroaches. We want to figure out what are the ways that we can save money. We're happy to do scrappy things. I mean, much of the Bitcoin mining data center design business, what makes it so interesting relative to, say, traditional data centers with, you know, high uptime requirements, is that Bitcoin miners, the quality of the data center design isn't just does it work and is the uptime high, but it's also, it, you know, is the uptime attractive for the cost that went in, right? Like if you could double your cost for another 5% of uptime, it oftentimes isn't worth it. And so I think this whole like cockroach engineering mindset where it's just, you know, you're basically building your Bitcoin mining data centers so that you can run your ASICs effectively, and so you can earn the most money possible. And you don't necessarily get, you know, brownie points just for having spotless waxed floors in your data center.
Yeah. And I want to pivot a little bit to just get your guys' ideas on the broader theme in the Bitcoin mining industry, which is this geographic dispersion of hash rate. It seems that there's a lot of activity happening in the Middle East, in Latin America, Nordic countries. Seems like China may be coming back online to a certain extent. How does that affect your view on the market overall? As America's been the big theme in the mining industry for the last 3 years, I think that will continue, but there is competition from other parts of the world where people are waking up to like, hey, this can actually be a profitable business. It can help our energy assets. Like that's another variable that's beginning to materialize and become a pronounced trend moving forward.
Yeah, I think I'm not sure how much it affects our business specifically in that we are quite conservative in the areas that we're willing to go. And just as fiduciaries and executives, you know, there's many states even within the US that we don't feel comfortable deploying hash rate in. And yeah, I guess you could say that many states within the US do have sort of a third world feel when it comes to doing business, because you don't know if the rug's going to get pulled out from under you without any advance warning. So I think there will be lots of like adventurous entrepreneurs who go out into Russia or China or parts of Latin America and the Middle East. We probably not on our roadmap anytime soon. I think there's a lot of wood to chop here in the US. And I think a country outside of the US would have to have a very long track record of supporting Bitcoin miners and property rights and things like that for us to really feel comfortable. But I don't know, it's not something we really talked about in a while. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think we've long thought that there will be opportunities for people willing to go further out in the geopolitical risk curve to get low cost power and really attractive operations. You know, I wonder if there are basically some like called like a black market Bitcoin mining consultants who like go and, you know, like arms dealers are basically making deals with random warlords who somehow have access to like cheap hydro or something like that to basically get them some hash rate online. But I think, yeah, Bitcoin mining, like my attitude is basically network hash rate's probably gonna, network hash rate's gonna go up. It's not a question of is it going to go up? It's just where is it going to go up? And I think the dispersion is natural. It makes sense, especially with, say, the publicly traded miners or the capital markets in the U.S. have definitely not been as receptive for Bitcoin miners lately. It's only natural that that's going to, you know, the hash rate's going to flow elsewhere, whether that's, maybe a nation state or some sort of quasi nation state entity that is has found a way to get themselves cheap power, whether that's by stealing it from the private sector or just causing their citizens to subsidize it. Or maybe the energy is just abundant. Who knows? I think this is going to continue to happen. And I think it's good. Like, we don't want all the majority of the network hash rate to be controlled by publicly traded Bitcoin miners in North America. That would be a really terrible outcome. So I think it's nice that there is sort of this natural self-regulating mechanism here, which is just there's only so much hash rate in the world.
Hash rate flows like water to where it is treated best.
There's only so much cheap energy in the world. There's so much rack space. Fascinating.
It has been really, really surprising, though. I mean, it feels like from a concentration standpoint, the percentage of hash rate in the U.S. peaked sometime in 2022. And the estimates that I'm seeing have more hash rate coming online in places like you mentioned, Marty, the Middle East, China, parts of Latin America in the last year. And it's been crazy to see how quickly that has sort of returned after the wave that we saw into the U.S. after the China ban.
Yeah. It's such a fascinating industry. It's very masochistic in a way, but it's incredibly...
You have to be a real glutton for pain to want to participate in the industry.
Yeah, but it's tantalizing, isn't it?
No.
Of course.
I still find it to be like cosmically and intellectually so beautiful, and it's such... like proof of work is such a beautiful mechanism. And I mean, energy is still such an interesting, this like endless rabbit hole, just as a concept. It's sort of like simultaneously still kind of retaining that appreciation and the love for Bitcoin, an appreciation for the beauty of energy and for the importance of like building physical things in the real world, you know, atoms, not bits. Paired with the fact that it is a ruthless business, that it can be incredibly brutal. And as we all well know, Bitcoin tends to solve for the path of max pain. But in the long run, you know, it inshallah, will still benefit us all.
Yeah. Agreed. It's a fun journey. The wives don't like it all the time, though.
Can't blame them. I do feel like I aged maybe about a decade during 2022, but...
Yeah, I definitely have some more gray hairs. I definitely, I definitely smoked maybe a couple cigarettes more than I should have. But I maintain that cigarettes are actually healthy for you, and the a nice organic vape. I think in general, it's definitely like looking over the last 2 years. It is really fun just in terms of how much growth comes from working in a business in an industry that is just so intense, 24/7, and really all you can do is just keep trying to make the best decisions you can along the path. So definitely it's been an insane learning lesson over the last few years, and I definitely feel pretty excited moving forward.
Yeah. And as we can see here on the block clock, we've got 27,950 oscillating above and below 28,000 this week. We've got the Fed holding rates higher for longer. At least that seems to be the consensus. If you look at treasury markets and a lot of the macroeconomic think boys out there, they're convinced. And I guess shifting this over to just Bitcoin, the asset, and what it's going to do over the next year as we approach the halving, before we get into how that will affect the mining industry, that's really this very interesting time in Bitcoin. Again, it's about to turn 15, at least the white paper is, in a few weeks here. And this is really the first time in Bitcoin's existence over the last year and a half that it's existed in an environment where rates are rising. And I think that's the big question looming in everybody's mind right now, is if the Fed does hold higher for longer, does Bitcoin disconnect from the markets despite that? Because I think a lot of people would make the argument that M2 money supply is a big driver of the Bitcoin price. When they're printing more money, a lot of that's going to flow to Bitcoin. And when they're pulling it out, Bitcoin's going to suffer as a result. But I'm not so convinced that adage will hold true over the next year, especially if this wave of institutional adoption that everybody's talking about by way of an ETF or similar products. I do think the incremental demand that market access could provide could outweigh anything that's happening with M2.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Regardless of what happens with the Fed funds rate or the macro backdrop, if Big Daddy Fink comes through with an ETF, a spot ETF, the price of Bitcoin is going to go nuts.
Yeah. And also thinking, in talking with both Alex Thorne and of Galaxy and James Seifert, who is the ETF analyst at Bloomberg, we had some meetups with them at PubKey in New York in the last couple months. And they basically have certainly sold me on the fact that so many different RIAs or family, you know, wealth managers, things like that, so many of them would basically just be at the ready to allocate 1% of their client's portfolio, of their portfolio, as soon as there's an ETF that's ready. I think it would just be like a massive capital inflow, you know, overnight. And I mean, I think the ETF will be very important, be very bullish. But I also think, I'm not sure how much longer this current sort of tightening cycle can go on for. You know, famously, I've been, you know, for the last
I didn't think they were going to go over 2.5%. And here we are at 5.5.
I remember we were talking at the very beginning of the hiking cycle. You didn't think they could raise interest rates 25 bips.
Yeah.
You didn't think they would get there. And you know what? It didn't sound crazy at the time. I was like more inclined to agree with you than the view that we were going to be at 5% within 18 months or wherever we are.
No, totally. And like, I think, you know, as having read the Ender's Game, you're basically like, all right, something's going to break at some point, and then that's going to cause the Fed to have to reverse. Now, something did break, the regional banks, but the Fed was able to paper over it with BTFP. You know, I think if they continue to try to hike and try to stay higher for longer, there's certainly, I don't know what the next catalyst would be, maybe whether that's, you know, corporates having to refinance or, you know, something else breaking. But I was talking with Larry Lepard about this earlier this week because we were both in LA for the mining event at Pacific Bitcoin. And Larry's view is that, you know, something in the bond market is probably going to get sufficiently disorderly that the Fed will have to step in. And he thinks that could happen very soon.
Now, whether or not it's already sufficiently disorderly, like for
it's pretty disorderly right now. But
TLT is down like 20% this year, which is unheard of.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, I don't know. Like, it's, I've been thinking since, I was inhaling the hopium that Arthur Hayes was peddling in Q2, Q3, 2022. I've thought that, you know, something's going to break and the Fed's probably not going to be able to keep hiking, but I've been wrong this whole time. So, who knows?
Yeah. At least for me personally, I find that a great way to just stress myself out and waste a bunch of time is to worry about what the price of Bitcoin is going to do in the next 6 to 12 months. When I'm like feeling a little bit either concerned or like worried, I like to just zoom out and remind myself of the very, very macro picture, which is, you know, we're clearly in the late stages of a massive credit bubble. You know, whether you look at sovereigns or the private sector, and, you know, the US debt continues to go up at an absurdly fast rate. And whether it's this cycle or another cycle in another couple of years, it's not sustainable. And like over the long term, we're going to be right here. If it's not in 12 months, that'll be fine. We'll live to fight another day. I do think though, like a lot of people are underestimating, or maybe it's not underestimating, but it's become popular in sort of hardcore Bitcoin maxi circles to sort of poo-poo the idea of being excited about the spot ETF. Just because obviously like BlackRock and others like them are, you know, large, you could argue they're an extension of the government and are large, highly regulated entities that, you know, may not have the best interest of Bitcoin and Bitcoiners at heart. But I think it would truly be one of a very small handful of the most important things to happen in the history of Bitcoin to get a spot ETF. I think, like, contrary to the narratives of, this is something Drew and I talk about a lot. We call it like the elite theory of Bitcoin adoption. Contrary to the sort of banking the unbanked narrative that we should be working in third world countries to help people who don't have access to financial services use Bitcoin, all of which is fine. Like, I think that's a great noble mission. That's not going to cause the price of Bitcoin to 100x. There's probably fewer than 1,000 individuals and organizations in the world that have that power. And I think BlackRock and some of the other asset managers that are filing for ETFs are among them. And if we really want Bitcoin to be successful, I think number go up is definitely a prerequisite.
I completely agree with that. The Global South meme and trying to service that market, like you said, AJ, extremely noble. But I think we could easily make the argument that getting people with the most amount of wealth in as well actually aids that noble goal, because if the price of number goes up, it helps the Global South and everybody using Bitcoin in that part of the world. And to make number go up, you need people to put their wealth in it. And a lot of the wealth is at the institutions that you just mentioned. Don't think that they'll be securing Bitcoin the right way, or that that is how most people should get exposure to Bitcoin. But whether we like it or not, Bitcoin's a permissionless system. At some point, it is likely that one of these products is going to get approved, and there's nothing you can do to stop others from buying Bitcoin. It's just ensuring that everything outside of that is done correctly and
right,
is done in a way that respects the fundamentals that make Bitcoin valuable in the first place.
Totally. Yeah. And I'm not saying we shouldn't be, you know, like pressuring folks like BlackRock to abide by, you know, consensus rules and, like, you know, be good stewards of Bitcoin and stuff like that. Of course we should be doing that. But in terms of just overall impact to the project of Bitcoin, something like a BlackRock ETF would be so enormous. I think even with the amount of hype that's been generated, it's still a little bit underappreciated. And that is really, the US dollar doesn't get pegged to Bitcoin by, you know, marginal countries in Africa and Latin America adopting Bitcoin. The US pegs the dollar to Bitcoin because Larry Fink, we basically seduce Larry Fink into joining our ranks and becoming a complete shill and advocating for his own financial interests by pushing Bitcoin on everyone.
Yeah, and as we think, at least like personally, and of course we only have like one narrow experience for, you know, coming to Bitcoin, but at least for me, it was number go up at first, you know? And so I think number go up is often the thing that seduces you into really starting to like grok what Bitcoin is and some of the really important ideology behind it. I mean, it kind of in a way will also, if a bunch of the billionaires that have already adopted, I think Bitcoin, have also provided some cover from a regulatory attack as well. You think about like Mike Novogratz owning, you know, how much Bitcoin he owns, and he's such like a large donor to the Democratic Party. You know, if a Democrat gets too negative on Bitcoin, Novo is probably going to give them a call if he hasn't already. And so, not saying that that's like perfect and that that's like great. You know, I think ideally we end up like living in a world where maybe people are living a little bit in a more like localized way. Maybe there aren't these massive government institutions who are, you know, wielding this like insane amount of power. But, you know, I think Bitcoin is a mind virus, and I think the more people that we can infect with the mind virus, the better. And I think an ETF, to AJ's point, really helps with that.
And by the way, that's why BlackRock and all these other asset managers are interested in launching an ETF product. It's not because they are part of an evil cabal. They might be part of an evil cabal, but I don't think it's a conspiracy to co-opt Bitcoin or change it in some way. I certainly don't think they're doing it to be altruistic and, you know, for the reasons some of us work on Bitcoin. They're doing it because they want to get rich, because they see there's a massive market opportunity. They're getting an incredible amount of interest from their clients and a bunch of really, really rich people who have their wealth with BlackRock. And that's why they want to get into the market. And that's good. Same reason we got in. Number go up technology.
You have to imagine there's been another conversations like, hey, if you don't find me a way to get access to Bitcoin, I'm gonna have to take my money somewhere else and get that access. Yeah. And at that point, it's like, all right, we'll go get it for you. We want to keep those fees within BlackRock.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And if they end up kind of following the path of a lot of these gold ETFs and they allow for physical withdrawals, all the better.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see. I'm optimistic. Very bullish right now.
Yeah, I think there's a lot, as always, there's much to be, there are many black pills, many white pills. I think there's much to be bullish about right now in particular. Like we kind of went through a pretty massive chaotic bear market over the last 12 months.
Well, that's the thing too, like the deleveraging that's happened in the Bitcoin market, like how many marginal sellers are there on the edges and how much Bitcoin do they have to actually sell at this point?
Yeah, totally.
Even in this high interest rate environment.
Totally. And even outside of Bitcoin, I feel like there's definitely there's signs of optimism, you know. Always many things to motivate you to keep on pushing to get to the quote promised land.
Yeah. All right, let's wrap this up on some halving talk. Are we optimistic about the halving? It's definitely going to happen at block height 840,000. What's it going to do for the mining industry? What's it going to do to the mining industry?
Yeah, I mean, you never want to bet on the direction of the Bitcoin price in the short term. So we're, you know, as a company, we're not betting there's going to be the typical full 4-year bull market where the halving happens and then subsequent to the halving, you start to see the price of Bitcoin going up. But, you know, it does seem like that is the most likely scenario at this point. If, you know, thinking about some of the macro topics that we've already touched on here, potentially like interest rates coming down around the same time, things like that. So, you know, we're optimistic. As I said, we're mostly focused on dialing in the efficiency of our operations, getting our break-even hash price as low as possible in the months leading up so that if we're wrong and, you know, the price of Bitcoin doesn't see meaningful appreciation afterwards, we're still able to continue generating positive cash flow.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think if you looking last year, it actually wasn't, I don't think hash price perfectly fell in half last year. I think hash price...
Last cycle.
Last cycle, I want to say hash price fell somewhere like 35%. And I think this is, again, why hash price is a useful metric, is that if you know, when the block subsidy gets cut in half, many miners are no longer going to be profitable. That's going to cause them to switch off. So it's not like a perfect 50% reduction in mining revenue.
I thought you had a good phrase the other day on one of our calls. You just have to be... You don't have to be faster than the bear.
Yeah. Just the guy next to you, just the Compass miner with 8.5 cent hosting for an M30. but I think it's like, but obviously, you know, there are going to be many folks who switch off. Obviously there are many miners who have incentives that aren't necessarily economic in nature, whether it's maybe trying to get money out of certain regimes or, you know, maybe they just want KYC free sats. Like, you know, I think there's many reasons why someone might mine at a loss on paper. But I think it really comes down to just battening down the hatches, knowing that they're you weather the storm. You know, whether or not there is the halving is what caused the bull market, I feel like we're about to re-enter that that sort of discourse all over again about the efficient market hypothesis. It's so tiresome. But like maybe the base take this whole time and the correct take this whole time was Fed's gonna hit the softish landing and Bitcoin moves in 4-year cycles. Like, who the fuck knows? But you know, I think we all agree that there's enough, the writing is on the wall that at some point in the next year or two, we are going to see a bull market just because, you know, again, Bitcoin just makes so much sense. And of course, sometimes it can make too much sense. It can cause you to make some bad short-term decisions, but it makes so much sense that it feels inevitable that we're going to see another bull run. Just a question of when. So in the meantime, having going to be bad, going to be painful, going to cause many to have to shut down, but we're doing everything we can to make sure we stay hashing no matter what.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think the base case for Bitcoin, not the base case, the bull case, I mean, particularly anchoring back to current conditions in treasury markets, even if something does break, the Fed reverses, there's still going to be that psychological seed that's been planted in people's minds that like, oh, like, are we going to stay at zero forever? What does that mean for the value of the currency? And if we don't, and the Fed does this again, like the treasuries are shit coins. Like they're not valuable risk-free assets that they've been marketed for decades. Like, we need an alternative. And I wrote this in the newsletter last night, like Bitcoin is the perfect alternative. Like if you, and it's the epiphany I had earlier this week, which is really just building on, okay, let's get back to first principles. What is a treasury? What is a government bond? You're lending government money to get your principal plus some yield back on the back end. And all right, it's a lending agreement. And who's your counterparty in this lending agreement? And how do they act? And you look at the U.S. government right now, we have a president who can't speak and form coherent sentences. We have House of Representatives that can't even pick a speaker right now. We have healthcare costs that are on the rise, and we're subsidizing that industry. We have a pretty inept education system here at the current point in time. We're dumping a bunch of this money into unreliable energy infrastructure. So if you're just looking at it as a lender and you're looking at the U.S. government as a borrower, it's like, holy shit, this person's a degenerate. They're already $33.5 trillion in debt. Like, how much longer can they borrow from individual investors, institutional investors, sovereign nations, banks, before people wake up and say, hey, this is not the option. Like, Bitcoin is probably a better liquid asset to save my long-term savings in. And then when you think about it too, like, if many people make that decision, the game theory plays out where people assume that others are going to make that decision. You increase number go up, you increase the purchasing power of everybody holding Bitcoin. And then you get this distributed wealth base that can then go out and actually invest productively, because there's actual opportunity cost involved in their decisions that the government doesn't have or hasn't had for a while, maybe re-entering the conversation due to people waking up to this fact right now. And it's just a much better option compared to treasuries. And so I think, long-winded way of saying, like, I think people are going to wake up to this thesis and really begin to grok this, like, oh, this bearer instrument is much better than this dead instrument. And we'll see material winding out of treasuries and into Bitcoin.
No, totally. And like, if you really want to store your own wealth and you want to do so in a way where there's no counterparty risk, and you do so in a self-sovereign way and in a way that's flexible, where if you needed to leave some location, you could and take all your wealth with you. You know, Bitcoin remains the best way to do that in the world. And I think, yeah, I was surprised there wasn't more of a bullish response after, like, the U.S. froze Russia's FX reserves. Like, regardless of what you think about the conflict, like, I think every government in the world knows now that the treasuries that you hold sort of can be taken away from you. You know, Arthur Hayes wrote about this a lot in 2022, where, you know, even if sovereigns and nation states start moving, you know, sovereigns or nation states with current account surpluses, even if they start rolling, you know, a small percent of that into other commodities, whether it's gold or oil or Bitcoin, like, that just seems like sort of a prudent risk management strategy at this point. And so I think, you know, the mind virus is going to continue to spread. As AJ and I once talked about in Prospect Park many years ago, you know, Satoshi, in a way, you could dumb it down to just, he put this little thing on a table. The only rule is that you can't make more of it. And naturally, as time goes on, everyone's just going to want to carve up a piece of themselves. Everyone's just going to want to get at least some of it. You can't make more of it. You might as well get some of it just in case it catches on. And so it's only natural that, like, as time goes on, as people sort of find the concept of Bitcoin less risky just because they're more familiar with it, I think you're just going to see more and more folks just waking up to the obvious incentive, which is, I should have some fucking Bitcoin. Like, I mean, I don't know, I don't need to put all my money to Bitcoin, but I need to have at least some. And so I think this is just going to continue to play out. And the fact that, you know, the current, call it, like, foremost global reserve asset, the treasury, is basically just showing more and more problems because of the government that's issuing it. It just feels inevitable.
Yeah. And to your point about the lack of reaction around Russia's, the freezing of Russia's treasury assets, I do think it's driven by greed, where people recognize that and said, particularly BRICS countries, and said, all right, this is not going to work. We should diversify away from treasuries. I think greed is driving. We're like, all right, we're going to create the solution to this. And we're sort of in this intermediary period where they're trying to solve that with their BRICS plus whatever basket of hard assets, or yuan back, gold back, oil back, whatever it may be. They're trying to figure that out, make that work when Bitcoin's there. And they recognize, because all these countries have to recognize, like, once they ape into Bitcoin, like, the field is level set and there's no going back. And there's still that geopolitical dick measuring contest where they don't want the field to be level. They want to sort of dominate the settlement currency of the world. And it's just going to take them time to realize, like, hey, it's not the way things are going to work moving forward. It'll take them time to realize that.
Totally.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. What should we wrap up with?
It really always is. What should we wrap up with? I don't know. A lot of cause for optimism. Just got to keep grinding, keep pushing.
Yeah. Many, I think hopefully there will always be pockets of human flourishing, or folks that really care about human flourishing as sort of an end in and of itself. And, you know, I think it basically just comes down to motivating yourself and keep pushing yourself and keep like trying to find those pockets so that you can, you know, create a, I forget how the way you typically describe it, Marty, but create a better world someday. And yeah. I think in general, I think there's still some tremendously bullish things in addition to Bitcoin. You know, there are many, many promising aspects for abundant energy, many, many other promising aspects for folks who do care about human flourishing and are really making that a priority, whether that's on the local level, near you or somewhere further away. So things very promising.
You heard it here first, freaks. Things are very promising. We're going to win. It's going to take time. But if anybody's going to lead us to victory, I think it's people that have been through the Bitcoin mining cycles. We've been through a lot. We've been dragged through the mud.
I thought you were going to say it's Larry Fink. But.
No. Larry can help. Get on board, Larry. I think part of the reason is he wants to put Bitcoin in an ESG fund and increase the CAGR of those funds so they can actually make money for the first time ever. But that's a tinfoil hat theory that we can touch on off the record.
Gentlemen,
thank you for coming back on the show. I'll see you in person next week, which I'm very excited for. And we got to do this more. We can't wait 18 months between episodes. Let's do this again soon.
Yeah, man. Whenever you want, we'll be back. And very much looking forward to hanging in person.
All right. That's all we got. That's all we got today, freaks. Peace and love.